Hey, it's Katrina with Zooming in the Lens and with Cara Albero. Hello, Cara.
Hi. So happy to be back.
Oh, yeah. It's been a long time. At least 3 or 4 podcasts, right?
I think maybe some more than that.
Yeah, possibly. I hope we get this podcast out in time. I think we will, because it's relevant to what's been going on this last week and until next weekend. What's the date today?
Today is the 24th of April.
The 24th of April, 2016, right?
Where I live, yes.
Well, you know, Cara and I were having a really interesting conversation, and I just sort of wanted to press record. Cara was telling me about a really great encounter that she had with her mother, and she's, I'm throwing her, what's that saying? I'm throwing you to the wolves. That's it. My brain's not working yet, Cara.
Throwing you to the wolves. I'm throwing you under the bus.
Yes, right. I always get those wrong. I get made fun of. Tommy always says that I say at the drop of a dime, and it's supposed to be the drop of a hat, but I then found out that it can be said as the drop of a dime.
That's a whole other conversation where all of those things come from.
Yes, you actually read a trivia book. That's right. That day I got that text.
The needle in the haystack, the quiet as a mouse. There's so many of them. And some of them come from somewhere and some of them don't. Matter of fact, I know this is way off the subject, but when I moved to where I live right now, before I moved up here, I had never heard the term redneck. And I hope I'm not offending any listeners right now, but nothing personal. It's just that I never knew that that expression was actually a thing. Like, there actually were people that were called that, and what the stereotype of that type of person was. I never knew that until I moved up here, for everybody who doesn't know, would be like 65 miles north of Manhattan. So very country, very, you know, urban, you know, suburb, no, rural, yeah. Right? Where there's not a lot of city life at all. And anyway, I started to see people out in the stores, and I was like, what is wrong with these people? I've never seen quite anybody quite like the way they dress and the way they talk. And somebody said to me, welcome to redneck country.
And I was wait, like, tell everybody where you came from. Did you?
I lived in, Nyack or Rockland County, which is like 25 miles outside of Manhattan. So much more city-like and, you know, more, I guess, modernized and cultural. I don't know.
Yeah.
I had never seen anybody that was fit that redneck stereotype. I actually only thought it was something like comedians made up or something. Here it was with people saying, you know, welcome to redneck country. And I was like, that's a thing?
And
anyway,
before that, Cara, you came from the city. So,
yeah.
And I imagine that Rockland County probably seemed rednecky to you. So it's all about your perception, really.
Well, Pete told me the other day that...
I mean the city of New York, sorry. See, New York, yes, they always say the city.
That is the city.
Because the world revolves around New York City, that you only have to say the city. And everybody gets it. No,
and everyone knows what you mean. No matter where you're listening from, you knew I meant New York City, right?
Man, we get stuck in old habits really quick, you and I.
Okay, so really, I'm just letting you know that Pete, my other half, told me the other day where the expression redneck came from.
Do tell.
I won't tell you exactly correctly because I don't remember all the facts, and he might not have given them all to me, but basically it was like a rival of two types of gangs, for lack of better words. They were country type of people that were vying for some land a long time ago, like hundreds of years ago. And to identify themselves in their big battle, they tied bandanas around their neck. And the rednecks won.
Whoa. Isn't that amazing?
So that actually is a thing that comes from a certain type of person who, you know, won their battle and they were the rednecks. And so that got passed down and passed down and passed down.
Well, I'd love to know how that became a derogatory statement, though.
I don't know that it's derogatory. It's just that people are judged by, you know, I guess that stereotype built on people that live in the country, that are underdeveloped, that don't have a lot of money or means, so they maybe hunt and eat instead of shop and eat. Mm-hmm. They don't have their dental work done and their dentures put in and the teeth whitened and polished. So if they fall out, they fall out. So maybe by their 40s, they have less teeth. Like all of the, they were a product of their environment.
Stereotypical and, sayings.
Yeah. Right. So it became derogatory by the people that aren't like that, that would look down upon their culture like any other culture and,
right,
you know, look at them because they're not who they are and they're, you know, it's not the same as they are in their eyes.
Well, speaking of stereotypical, will you share your story with us?
My Pesach story?
Your Pesach story. Yes.
Well,
and good, happy Pesach, right? Good Pesach.
Good Pesach.
Good Pesach.
Yes.
Yes, good Pesach to everybody out there.
Everybody, even if you're not Jewish, celebrate the freedom of the slaves.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was Passover. You know, and the different meanings behind it. And I think your story really is a great lead into it. Maybe not. Anyway, it's a great story. So please do tell.
Well, my first part of the story just happens to be Passover time, but it in itself didn't have anything to do with Passover, but we did tie it in because of the feelings and the emotions that it brought up, and I connected it to my Passover experiences, and it happens to be Passover now, so it is all related. So I had an experience where my mom invited me to a party. She was invited to a party, and she said she wanted me to go with her.
Mm.
And I immediately asked her, where is it? You know, who is it? It was a family member, an aunt, a great aunt on her side. And it was her 90th birthday. And this is family that I knew and grew up with when I was younger, far younger, like 40 years younger, and have had no contact whatsoever with over all of these years. So I don't know anyone. I don't know their children. They don't know mine. There's no involvement. And, you know, the woman's turning 90. Happy birthday. I'd wish that to any other stranger, but basically that's all she is to me. Mom asked me to go. She said it was important to her. And I said, okay, well, if it's important to you, then I'll go. She didn't want to go alone. Her significant other wasn't able to go. So I said I would go. And when I protested and told her why I didn't want to go, her defense was, well, it's family, it's this, she's this, you know, her uncle, you know, the whole family history I got. And it meant nothing to me. I felt nothing when she said it. And, you know, I say all the time, my friends are my family, the people I choose to participate in my life, to share my joy, share my sorrow, to talk to, grow with, learn from. That's my family.
Hmm.
And that's, I guess, what is a family. Maybe that's different to everybody, but I feel like in a lot of cultures, specifically Jewish culture, probably Italian, Catholic, or whatever, however you want to classify it, also the family, you know, and Greek, right? The Greeks.
You know what? I think it's just a human condition at this point.
The family. It's your family.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, it's your family. So that was being thrown at me. It's your family. And I said, you know what? If it's important to you, I'm going to go because you want. That's my only.
Right.
Anyway, today was the day of the party. And as I was getting ready this morning, she called me to confirm the pickup time. And she said, we will be there to get you at 10:45. And I said, wait, who's we? And she said, me and Indio, her significant other. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, but if he's going, why am I still going?
Oh, because you were under the assumption that she wanted you to go because she didn't want to go alone?
Yeah, she said she wanted me to be with her because she, well, she wanted me to be with her. She loves me. She wanted to spend a day with me, whatever. But it was more important that she just didn't want to go by herself. She doesn't like to drive alone. She didn't really want to go into a place where she probably only knew a couple of people by herself. And that's fine if those are her reasons. And for her, I would do that. Mm-hmm. You know, just spend the day with my mom. But if she had him to escort her, my company was no longer necessary. And when I said that to her, she got like disappointed. Her voice was very disappointed. Oh. And then she followed that with, well, you know, it's Aunt Shirley's 90th birthday party. And she'll probably like, I mean, this will never happen again. The next thing will be her funeral. And I said, to which I will not go either. I mean, it was the first thing that came to my mind. Like, are you telling me that she's going to have a funeral because you think it will evoke emotion of sorrow? I mean, I don't want anybody, don't want to hear of death. I'd be sad.
Of course, yeah. Right.
But not like I'm losing something from my life. I have no connection to anybody there in that family. I don't wish anybody unwell. I just, what do? Make small talk, talk about things that happen in your life. They have no concern or connection to me in my life now or over the last 4 years. So I had no desire. Well, I had an out. She had an escort. I took the out. I asked her if she was upset. She said no. I said, what do you feel in your heart right now? And she said, no, I'm okay. And I said, because if you're hurt, I will go. The only reason that I offered is because you asked me to for you. And she said, no, I'm okay. Angie's going. You do what you have to do. And that was it. And I didn't go. But it didn't connect me to those thoughts and feelings, especially now being Passover, of my childhood. And you go because it's your family.
Right.
And I did it to my children. That was what brought us to that conversation.
Well, you caught yourself doing it.
Totally. I caught myself doing it years ago. I haven't done that in years, but I know that I used to. And is it just because you grew up with people saying that to you? Probably. Mm. You go. It's tradition. It's your family. I mean, do you want to go anywhere you're forced to go that you don't want to be? And furthermore, do you want people with you that don't want to be there?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so that's where that brought me to, all of that. And I just thought it was really interesting, like, how I felt so nothingness about it and how she felt, but it's your aunt, but she's 90, you know. It's just, I'm not sure. You said something interesting. Is it that she really didn't want to go and maybe couldn't dig down and find that real feeling inside that said, why should I drag my ass to Long Island today? I don't really want to go.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I know that I love to think about that most of the time, my sister, one of my sisters, she had this habit of calling me. I guess it must be, she hasn't done it in over 6 or 7, maybe 5 years or so now, but what she used to do, the minute I moved out of the house and I was an adult, she would call me and say, you know, Diana's brother's girlfriend? Yeah, I had a really good conversation with her at the party, you know, 10 years ago, whatever. Well, she passed away suddenly, and I really think it would be a very nice gesture if you go to the funeral. And I immediately would feel that clinching. I didn't know how to relate it at the time. But when I go back in my memory, my sister had this sort of habit of, you know, then somebody would be in the hospital that I've never met. And she would call me and say, you should really make a visit to the hospital and see this person. And when I would say no, or I don't have time, or I can't, she was, she would give me guilt, like, and go, you know, she goes for the jugular. That's my sister's thing. I'm sure everybody has siblings out there that know exactly where to get you. And this one in particular did have that skill with me. And she would say, oh, well, just because you don't know them, and, oh, sorry, does it not fit into your busy schedule? You know, you name it. You know, and certain things get certain people at certain times in their life, and that's what family does. They know what vein to hit. They want to get you.
And what is it about somebody like that? That, how do you explain somebody that just wants to be in a bad place, or likes to be in a bad place,
right,
and likes to bring you to that place?
I mean, that's everybody. It's just whether you're conscious of it and working towards seeing where we're caught, or you're not. And so then what becomes our practice, Kara, is how we react to that, because we can't ask them to change. I mean, we can, and then we'll just suffer more. But for me, I just, the story that of you and your mother, it just made me think of how many of us want the misery loves company. But if I was to ask, because I love your mother and I know your mother, if I was to ask her, she might not even be aware of either A, you're right, maybe she didn't really want to go. Maybe she feels awkward showing up by herself. Maybe she is going because of the guilt that she was raised on. And so what better than to be somewhere where you're there because you feel guilty? But at least around you is your family, your people, however you categorize that. So then the guilt process starts. But really, you know, the one important thing, I know I'm slightly regressing, is I don't think we should necessarily run away from those situations all the time, or push them away. I think the important part of the story is that, for those of you that don't know Kara, Kara is a constant giver, and she works all the time and does what she has to do and maintains a spiritual practice, because the things she does in life are the spiritual practice. So if she has a day or a half a day to take to herself, she really should be doing that. That's self-care, and that's a really part of just growing up, is learning how to care for yourself and when to say no.
Yeah.
Right? That's a hard thing to do, especially when you're dealing with holidays and
parents.
And parents, and I mean, shit, I know friends that could guilt you into stuff. So that the important part that might have been missing from that story is, it was a good thing for you to have some self-care. And it's not that your mother doesn't know that, or does know that and should or shouldn't have asked you. It doesn't matter. That's not, yeah. A, she loves you more than anybody in this world. So it wasn't about that. And I don't know her mental state and whether she really wanted to go or not. She could have just been like, no, I feel no guilt. I want to go. But let's just use a hypothesis that she didn't want to go, or that she, misery does love company. It's like we're on this reflex, this reaction mechanism of, if we feel slightly awkward or uncomfortable, or we don't want to be alone, this ability to like call up the people that we love
drag them in
and say, hey, I'm in hell. I really could use some company. I mean, that would be great, actually, if somebody was that
just
aware.
Just say it like that.
Yeah. Like, because I think I would be receptive more to that.
Because I felt bad about my reaction inside, and I would never laugh in her face. I wouldn't do that to anybody that I love. But to hear her say something like this, but she's 90 years old. How many people in the world are 90 years old? Should I fly around and visit all of them?
That's exactly what I said to Jenna when she would call me and tell me I should go to this person's bedside at the hospital. And I'm like,
stop in all the rooms while you're there.
I might as well. I mean, I would love to now, but I mean, as a young adult, I didn't know how to react. And all it did is get me and my sister into a fight because she was trying to guilt me into something. I felt like a shitty sister. And then I felt like a shitty human being on top of it. And all she represented to me at that moment, and in many other moments after that, whether she was asking me to do something or not, I just had this muscle memory of like, why do I need to be guilted into something? What is it about us that wants to drag people in and out of it? And, you know, I know that if we were to have those people here now, it's not like we're in touch with those feelings. And it's not like I haven't done that myself. Of course I have. But I remember in my 20s, I had one girlfriend in my whole life that was able to do this. And then when I got older, I have another girlfriend now that I know that can do this. And ironically, I don't know that for sure, so I won't say that. But they're two people that never put pressure on their kids. Because this one that I'm thinking of from my past had kids very young. And the girlfriend from now, if her husband doesn't want to go somewhere, she doesn't. Okay. Even if it's for the kids. She doesn't pass judgment on him. She doesn't say to me behind his back, ugh, he never goes anywhere. All she ever says is, he doesn't want to go, he doesn't want to go. I'm not going to force him. And there was that part of me that was raised in that same landscape that you were, that was almost like appalled that she was so okay with that. And I also, you know, I'm thinking back to it now. That's why I'm pausing for a minute. I'm thinking back to, it was probably around 8 years ago. And I wasn't, you know, I was maybe 2 years into my practice at the time, which is like a week, you know, in regular time. Yeah, it's
a minute.
It was
like 5 minutes in.
It was like 5 minutes in, right? Because now I'm only like 15 minutes in. And I remember having the thought, wow, your husband is walking on you. He's like walking all over you. He's like,
oh,
you know that feeling?
Of course I know that feeling because what's around us is the unspoken, if I want to do it, you should want to do it.
Right.
What is that? I mean, yeah. And that is all we knew. So yes, I'd be horrified if somebody was okay with them wanting to do something and their significant other just not wanting to go and they're just okay with it. And now, because of my progression with the whole thing with the family, my children, and now in my relationship, everybody knows if it's important to me, I will tell you. Otherwise, I'll just put it out there. Like, this is happening just in case you want to come. And I will have full intention of going alone. I'm always okay with going anywhere. But if your company is really means something to me, I will tell you that and I will tell you why. So that if that option's not taken, like I said to you before, I might be disappointed, but that's still my problem.
Absolutely.
You know, but I won't ever be like, you should feel bad because you don't want to go because I want to go. And I think you should want to go because I want to go.
Right.
It's just, right. It's so really preposterous. Like,
yeah. And it wouldn't have helped you in the moment to say, well, why, you know, why, mom, do you not really want to go and you just want me to come? Like, no. It's irrelevant at that point because it's not something that you even want to try to control because we can't even get to grips with it within ourselves. But, you know, I find it really interesting to that it brings me back to all the times that it was just an autopilot reaction that your husband should be there or your children should be here. It's the holidays. And we never really had any discussions in our childhood as to like, but why? It was completely about respect, because growing up I was raised Italian Catholic, and it was just, you do that. And it was a sign of respect. If your husband didn't go, it was the sign that he didn't respect you, or he wasn't a family man, or, and if your mother didn't force her kid, like if a mother showed up at a wedding and her kids were invited and the kids weren't there, there was something wrong, and everybody would like whisper, you know, like, she doesn't have control, you know, whatever it is. And you can't win in those situations, because then you bring the kids and they are horrible and they're still going, she has no control over her kids. Like, you can't win, right? But I'm as interested in that, and you and I are a bit removed from it, but these are all the interesting parts of how to bring your practice into your daily life.
Yeah. Because I really didn't, through all the days that preceded today, I didn't really look at the situation. I reacted to her question. I told her how I felt. The weeks are going by and I'm going on with my life. And as this weekend was coming, I said to Pete, I got to go Sunday with my mom. So I can only put in like Saturday at the house. I won't be there Sunday. And he said, oh, do you have to go? And I said, well, I mean, no, I told mom I'd go. She really wants me to go. So I just resolved myself to the fact that I was going, and I didn't dig down deep because I was real with how I felt. I was honest with her, and I made it was just okay. I wasn't going for any other reason than to be by her side because she wanted me to, and that was going to make her day easier, end of story.
Right.
Without attachment or, you know, dreading it and going anyway or any of that bullshit.
Yeah.
And then that phone call came this morning and I was like, but wait, why am I going then? You know, then it was just like, what? And then it all afterwards, that's when I was texting you, because that's when the practice kicks into, you have all this clarity of what actually happened, how you reacted to it, how you really feel or don't feel about these people and what family is or isn't. And the labels of this is your family. You know, I started hearing all those things in my head.
Right.
And look, flashback on how I was to my children. And, you know, the things just sheds all this light on all these different things that you grow up with, you become accustomed to, and you do learn through your life, and you can be aware. You know, that witness, if you could just jump out of your body every time and just look down and say, okay, what's happening right here right now? I know that whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's how you learn.
Well, you just get some space from it you get a little bit of space from it, and you can see yourself in the predicament. Like, you're not, look, I'm gripped. Look, this is gripping me. And you were under the assumption that you were going for a bunch of reasons, but if one of those reasons would have been changed, like, she could have called up and said, not about Indio, but, oh, by the way, I haven't talked to these people in 20 years either. That would have garnished the same reaction from you.
Oh,
what do you mean?
She gave me one weak spot that she had any doubt, and only I was going because she didn't really want to go. If she admitted that to me, I'd have jumped over.
Right. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. It's not like every time your family says something, you should speak up for yourself and put your foot down and say, I'm not going to go, and wait for the weak link. And it's not the other way that you should go every single time a family member says for you to go to a hospital or go to a funeral or a wedding or Passover. I think the great part about practice is that I look at what has my patterns been. And my patterns have been to just blindly go with, you know, it's that story you were telling me about somebody else. I won't reveal because it's not my business to say who it is, but somebody in your life that reacts when things get shifted around. Mm-hmm. You have plans. There's 20 people coming to dinner. They have to know right away. They have to know a month before. And if the plans change, it's not like anything's ever happened to you. Like, this person has never docked you and like and cut your arm and said, that's it, you're cut from the family. But just the feeling of letting somebody down, or you know this person has this issue, and so you right. go out of your way that if you say you're going to be there, you're going to be there. And I very much grew up that way. That saying of all you are is your word. And oh. yeah. And if you say something and you don't do it, oh, your everything good you've ever done is down the drain. Wow. Because you are viewed based on what you are doing right here, right now, and not in the good right here, right now. But, you know, I can also see that from, like, you don't gather up karma coins either. You were great last week, so this week you can screw around and not be great. But I think my point in saying that to you was, like, if your pattern has always been to just say yes and do it, then it would be a moment to actually stop and question, but why? But why am I feeling gripped? And let me tell you, the mind is so clever. It's given me a million reasons why I should show up at my sister's friend's boyfriend's mother's hospital bedside that I've never met. My mind will give me a million reasons. But I can't even get to those reasons because I'm so trapped in the how dare you ask me that? And then, not to call you out, but I think it's a great, it's a, just too juicy for me not to, and believe me, I'm just as guilty of it too. But to then throw back the dart. This is such a throw, oh my, this is such a throwback dart thing of, okay, well, I'll go if you really want me to. And then, bam, it's all in your lap. It's all now I have no responsibility to actually stop and say to myself, but why do I feel like I need to go? And it, is it what's right for me? What is it serving? What's the bigger thing? If I'm going to go to just be there for somebody, why does it have to have all these conditions on it? Why does it have to be Indio couldn't go? I don't want her to go alone. Oh, it's her safety. She can't drive at night. So that's a good reason. I haven't seen this person in 20 years. I don't need to go, but it matters to her. So then the brain, you feel this ping pong, right?
Yeah, I had all those things.
Of course, we all have all those things. But it's funny how the mind is so like, I don't want to go, I don't want to go. Well, all right, well, let me shoot one back at you. If you really want me to go, then I'll go. But really, we're doing the same thing that they're doing. And we're, what she's doing is she's shirking her responsibility that it's her family. And if she feels ties and she wants to go and you don't, and you can tell when somebody doesn't want to go. If when you call them up and you go, hey, you want to go to Aunt Shirley's 90th birthday party? If it's anything.
Invitation.
If it's anything, but I would love to. It's probably an indication that they don't want to go. So it's not like you have to dig deep to try.
You mean if it's, hey, you want to go to Aunt Shirley's 90th birthday party, and you immediately get a no, not really.
Exactly.
That was the first thing out of my head.
Right. Right. And you keep pushing, right? So then that's the invitation right there.
Yeah.
Right there is the invitation for her to say, all right, let me call you back. Hang up and say, what is it about this that's making me want her to go and feel like she should want to go? That's the bigger thing, right?
Yeah.
And then you hang up, she gives you an opportunity, and you go, why am I so appalled at going? And then that gives the opportunity to us to say, why do I have all these restrictions? Why do people, and you know, it's the us and them thing that we're all stuck in. It's that separateness, right? Which, you know, believe me, this all comes around to Passover, which we're going to get to very shortly. But it's that only family are worth it. No, only family I've seen in the last 20 years. Nope. 10 years. Nope. 5 years. Nope. People that have sent my daughter a graduation card. Nope. When I got married, that relative sent me a gift and they didn't even come. So you see, it's never ending, right? The mind's always going to do it.
We're quantifying
right.
who that person is.
Right.
And like I said to you before, without any of those parameters or quantification or qualifications or conditions,
yeah.
to me, if you participate in my life, you're in my life. That's it.
Why? That's what I'm going to challenge you on. Not that I'm coming from a place of I can do that. I'm intrigued about the conversation of why does it have to be somebody that participates in your life?
Well, there's no have to. I don't care about what it's for myself. What my reaction to who and what and why I want to be around or go to or accept an invitation to, in my mind, is people that are a participant in my life. What that means is a myriad of things. It doesn't mean you have to call me every day, once a week, once a month. No. It means that there's some connection there. I can't even tell you what the connection is because it varies from people I see often to people I talk to rarely, but it's just there, whatever it is to me. And that could be different for everybody else.
Right. So, like, let me just ask you a question. Do you want, actually, I'm not going to form it in the form of a question. Forget that. We all want those connections, right? And when we have family feels like, or family, friends, however you're categorizing that, feels like a connection, a participation. But how do we get those, right? They had to start somewhere. So unless we don't want any more connections and any more participation from anybody else, you don't know that by showing up at Shirley's 90th birthday party, you weren't going to sit down at the dais table to get a drink of water and have the greatest connection and participation with somebody that now for the next 20 years, it'll only be that person, right? So no, I'm not saying you, Kara. What I'm saying is,
no, you don't know.
It's limited.
I agree with that.
The thinking is limited. The issue isn't so much with just our parents and the way we grew up. It's that you and I are carrying that on. We're just doing it in less obvious ways because even the response to your mother, to my mother, to my sister, those are fully loaded too. I look at it as if we can come up with an intention, a bigger intention, coming from a place of, because obviously you have to have this to start it. We don't know everything. Okay, so I'm assuming that everybody out there understands that you don't know everything. And that you could even go so far as to say, we know nothing. So if we could start with just, I don't know everything. If we don't know everything, could it be that if we have an intention, like, let's just use, for me to practice with somebody, for me to take on a student, what I say to myself is, can I serve them and can they serve me? That took me a long time. I said it for a long time without actually feeling it. and then I said it and then felt it. So sometimes you just have to say things out loud for a while and then you catch up to it. So let's just use that as a hypothetical. I don't know everything. For me, I feel I don't know anything. And is it serving me and is it serving others? Well, my smaller intentions, no, it's not serving me and it's not going to serve anybody for me to be somewhere that I don't want to be in. Am I in a space where I could open up to it possibly serving something outside of me, the mind, and me knowing that it'll serve me or them? That's possible. It's possible that it could serve me and serve others in a larger context that I'm aware of. But can I practice through it? And what that means to me is, can I say yes to my sister and show up at the hospital without holding a huge grudge over my sister, without feeling bullied and pressured, without getting there? Who am I showing up as by the bedside of this so-called stranger, right? Who is it in me that's showing up for this person by the time I get to the hospital? I'm a raging bitch because I'm holding all this resentment and I'm being pushed there and pushed there and pushed there. That's not practicing through it. I mean, maybe it could be in a larger context, but I'm making somebody else suffer at that moment because they have to suffer through my bitchiness. That woman doesn't want me there because I'm a bitch at that point. I'm not serving her. So I think there are times in our life that there are things we do not want to do on one level. I'll say that levels are two, right? Katrina 2, Kara 2, the personality, the things we think, and we're really, you know, in the ego mind about it. And if you can't see your way out of it, it becomes an opportunity just because you reacted to it. And the fact that you're laughing about it, that's, to me, if there was going to be success, that's success in practice. Because it's not like it happened years ago. It happened a couple hours ago. And you're laughing about it. It becomes not so personal in it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at it, and this is just, I'm saying this because we brought up the word, I love you, I'll be there for you. So, you know, our definition of what love is, it might be different than what the wisdoms teach us, which is that love is unconditional. So what if your mom wanted you there, but she also didn't want to go, had somebody else to go with, could drive at night, and what if she had no reason, but she just wanted you to go? So I think in the world of the teachings, there's no conditions. But what your mother then, what we would be spreading to each other is, I'm not going to ask somebody to go unless I'm in touch with the feelings of why I want them to go and if I really want to go.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right? So if that happens, then less people ask things of you. We can't control that, of course. Those are other people's. The best way to change the world or change the circumstances around us is to change ourselves from the inside. So in that moment, I think if you were somebody that did that all the time, no, I don't want to go, no, I don't want to go, then I would say that was an opportunity. You could have went and seen what showed up. It's still an opportunity, right? Yeah. No matter how you look at it, it's always an opportunity. Pretty much everything is. Because there's not like, I'm not sitting here saying that my experience and my practice has been that it's any one way. It's being able to have the space. That's what practice gives to me. It gives me that space when somebody else won't, like my mother or my sisters. And when I create that space in myself, it occurs to me, it hits a different part of me. And I don't start to give that person therapy. I don't start to like say to my sister, well, what's the real reason you want to go? I mean, that would be pretty ballsy of me to do. But I could get in touch with my feelings of like, how much does it really, I am kind of full of shit in this moment that I'll do it if you really want me to.
Yeah, but here's something really interesting as an opportunity to learn, as everything is, yeah. Right? So from an opportunity to learn, opportunity to practice. Mm-hmm. You're posed with this now. Now we've talked about it for a while, so the whole situation's in front of you.
Yeah.
You have the opportunity to learn in where you actually are honest with how you feel at the moment and how you express that to somebody else and how it's interesting that you just feel disconnected from the situation and the people, and you're honoring that feeling in yourself that there's something else that you'd rather be doing in that moment and being somebody who usually says yes and is more of a giver. Right. So it's interesting to find that part of yourself that can stand up for yourself and say, you know what, this really serves me better today, honestly, and I hope that you're okay with that, because I'm okay with that. But on the other side of it, what if I did just go, just because what would it be like to do something you're completely uncomfortable with, have no desire to do?
Opposed to.
Just go and see what happens. I mean, you'd be more unlikely to do that, but that also would be an opportunity.
So interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because we just go, I know what I'm opposed to. I don't want to go. But why? Because I don't. And then the mind comes up with all this stuff of like, because I don't know them, they didn't send a birthday card, all that stuff starts.
So what? And in the answer to all of that could be, so what?
Well, yeah, and the answer in my mind, back to my mind, is you have no idea what love is, Katrina, at all. Because you're pissed off that somebody's putting all these conditions and expectations on you, and yet you're doing the same thing with saying, are they worth it? Should I do this?
Mm-hmm. Here come all the conditions.
Absolutely.
Open the bag and take the conditions out. Yes. It's like if someone says to you, it's the whole concept of, would you cut your pinky off for $10? Would you lose it? If I said to you, I'm going to take an axe and chop off your pinky and give you $10, you'd be like, no. Would you do it for $100? And just keep going. Would you do it for $50,000? Would you do it for $1 million? $5 million? $20 million? At some point, somebody will say to you, yes, it's just a pinky. It's just a pinky at $10.
Right. You got it right.
So it's all relative.
It is. And it's all this moment to say, I think what we instead look for, well, what are you saying is the right answer? I should have gone or I shouldn't have gone. There is no right answer, man. Like, I don't know it. If it is, I mean, maybe somebody else does, but to me...
Wait, did we tune into the $64,000 question here?
Yeah, there is no right answer because everybody's predicament is different. And what have you been dealing with your whole life? What have you never done before? Have you never learned how to care for the self? You don't need a reason. That's the real funny part about all of it. You don't need a reason to not go somewhere. When you know that where that is coming from in you, if you can just have that moment of reflection, even if it's not a great reflection, to look at that in yourself and not tell anybody.
Yeah.
And just write it down so that you could see, how else is this showing up for me in my life? Because I guarantee, for me, it has. What I'm opposed to, You start to see I wish you could see facial expressions in podcasts, but it's almost like you stand outside of yourself and you get this feeling like you're a detective. And you're like, oh, so you're opposed to that now, are you? No, I'm not opposed to that. I mean, you literally have these like ping-pongings back and forth, you know, but the one thing that all the great wise people that have come before us, religious, non-religious, have said is, when you have what's the word, it's with a P, when you have
give me a little little bit of more definition.
Oh, it's the way, the way, the Tao, the way. When you have, oh boy, you ever have that moment when just like things are gone from your head?
Lots of them.
Not perceptions, it's preferences. Thank you. You know what? That teaches me right there that I should just say the word that I mean, because that word jogged my memory. When you have preferences, you're going to suffer. Now, it. I know that that sounds like, well, what am I supposed to not like it? No, you can like and dislike as many things as you want. But cultivating that part of you that understands where those things are coming from, that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I didn't grow up having any knowledge of Jewish teachings. It's probably a really shitty segue, but...
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, I had more knowledge than you because even though your mom is Jewish...
Well, I feel like that's an honorable thing to be, as I would about anything let's put it this way. Her half of her lineage comes from Jewish roots. But I feel like I don't walk around saying I'm Buddhist. Do I love Buddhist teachings? Do I practice Buddhist teachings? Yes, but I can't wear that. And my mother had a desire to become Jewish a couple of years ago. And it so happens that her lineage, half of her lineage is from Judaism, but we were raised Catholic and Italian. And so what I keep doing is trying to inspire my mother to if she wants to call herself Jewish, that there is a responsibility in that, to actually study a little bit, pray, meditate, whatever it is. I don't think it's just a lineage, and my mother disagrees with me completely. But what I've seen in the West is that there's a load of us, I'll include myself, because I would walk around saying I was Catholic, right? And I did get I had a communion and I went to religious school and all that, but it means more. And that's where we get that saying of spiritual, I'm spiritual, but not religious. That comes in handy for people like you and I. Because there's a lot of people walking around saying they're Jewish, Catholic, Christian, Buddhist. And they don't, you ask them what Passover is about, or Rosh Hashanah, or Easter. And the way I grew up, I have absolutely met people that have said, I am Catholic through and through. Well, what is Easter? And they just know about the Easter bunny and eggs. So,
which has nothing to do with
it. Has nothing to do with it. So I'm just saying that I hold it in very high regard for somebody to say my mother is Jewish. I feel that comes with a big responsibility, as it would if I call myself a yogi. So I just felt like I had to say that, because I don't want there to be any disrespect towards Judaism, or my lack of being steeped in it either.
Well, I was going to just forward that, follow that up with saying that you didn't grow up with any Jewish teachings in your life, even though that was her heritage.
I wasn't even aware that she was Jewish.
Right. Well, right. She didn't really have much of her own opinions either, really, until, she wouldn't have talked about her heritage because she really didn't speak much about anything that was related to her. Interesting, her past until later on.
She let my dad's lineage take over.
Whereas I was raised with the pseudo Jewish family, and again, I'm not to disrespect anybody, but I have a lot of friends that are Catholic that are they're cherry pickers, it's how the world is. I have the utmost respect for people that are true to their religion, because I think there's less hypocrisy in, and not that this is a religious debate, but just to set the outline and the guideline of the Hasidic people are very true to their faith and their beliefs, and they really don't stray from them. And that's when you can quantify yourself as something if that is how you live and breathe and practice, which I think probably the highest portion of our population does not.
Well, it just confuses people. Don't you feel like it gets confusing? Because it's it confuses people. Because if everybody's Jewish and everybody's Catholic, I mean, not to even speak about the separation of that all, but I'm not saying you have to earn it, okay? I'm not saying that at all. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be cherry picking. But there is a distinction between just being born Jewish, for me, just being born with Jewish blood or Catholic blood, but doing nothing about it in regards to knowing what that means to you or even what it means to the Jewish heritage.
Yes, and integrating that into your lifestyle. I think more so in the way that we would practice the teachings of Buddha and apply them to our life and use them to learn.
And if you're going to say that you're, that's my point, is if you're going to use that to as a description of yourself, I am Jewish, I have to first know what that means to you.
Right.
So I just got very careful.
I don't say that. Both of my parents are Jewish. There's nothing but Jewish religion, all different countries on both sides, because the Jews were, you know, nomads and kicked out of countries and born in all different countries in the world, kicked out of Egypt, as goes the story of Passover, which is why, by the way, when people say I'm Catholic or I'm Protestant, they don't say I'm Catholic Irish. When people say, what are you?
Exactly.
Most people say their country of origin. I'm Irish, I'm German, I'm Italian. But the Jews all say, I'm Jewish.
Yes, yes.
Even though they're Polish and they're Russian and they're Austrian, because they were never from one country.
Right.
They were from many countries because of their, you know, unfortunate World War II, and they were scattered and raped. And,
right.
You know, there's a million reasons why. Yeah. But the practice and knowledge of the heritage comes in all religions. Do you really know? Like you said, I think most people don't. Again, my bloodline on both sides, they're all Jewish. Nobody was raised to follow the teachings of the Torah.
Or what about, even if you don't follow them, what are they? You know what I'm saying? Like,
I touched a Torah for the first time at my nephew's bar mitzvah last June. They rolled it out when he was reading the pastor at his bar mitzvah. And do you know that they are handwritten?
Yeah.
On this amazing paper, tiny little Hebrew letters. It blew my mind.
Wow.
I had never had anyone unroll a Torah and allow me to touch it and get close enough to see it. And I had a moment where the hair on the back of my neck stood up to think of what goes into the person that's writing that. I mean, how many Torahs are there in the country? They're not printed on a printer. Everyone is someone sits down and writes them. And then they're rolled up in those gigantic scrolls and they're always kept in a special cabinet. It's like, it's amazing. And I couldn't even tell you why, although I'm sure there is a why attached to it.
It's amazing too that, you know, really what it's sort of occurring to me as you're speaking, we're talking about making something sacred. And if we don't make anything sacred and everything is just words, 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 and titles and labels, and how could it not result in us and them? Like, you're good because I'll bring you around because you're Catholic and I'm Catholic, and so there we are. Or, you know, I'm Jewish and you're Jewish, so here we are. And the separation, it saturates and loses the sacredness of what it is. Or what it's like. So I'm not saying that there's a religion or a belief system or a teaching that's right or wrong, but what I'm saying is if anything was going to be shoved down our throat, it has been religion and roles and models. And when we can't even make that sacred because we're calling each other these titles and we've not even gotten curious about what that is at all, I feel that we lose those teachings, right? So I think my point in the whole thing is that I was not raised Jewish. I wasn't even aware that my mother had Jewish lineage until years after my father passed away. And I feel like I was robbed of some really great teachings. I've been studying a translation of the Hebrew text, the Torah, the Bible. And the story of Passover has been enthralling me for months now. And yeah, there's part of me that, you know, these teachings, when looked at like you would look at all the teachings that I've studied from Ram Dass to the messages of Neem Karoli Baba to love and feed people, I could read something like this and very easily be in my Katrina 2, my mind alone, and feel no connection and look at the story and see it from a very linear perspective where it's like, what does it have to do with me? Why do I care? There are a million reasons. I don't even care why it isn't hitting me in that way because it's irrelevant. But when I looked at this through this other lens of, I'm interested in this heritage of people that were exiled. And what is the story of it? And as I read it, I felt this almost, God, what else? What else am I missing? What else have I missed of my own quote unquote raised and cultivated belief system that my father tried to teach us through Catholicism? You know, I know I'm not making much sense of it, but I just wanted to share with anybody that doesn't go by the title of being Jewish. Even if
anybody, excuse me, but if anybody does want to read the story of Passover, you can just read the Haggadah. Haggada, Haggadah. It is the handbook that you read during a Seder, which is the Passover dinner. And the Seder plate is made up of all the symbols of Passover. Mm-hmm. And the Haggadah explains what the symbols are, the groups of people that are represented, and the story of the Jews that were forced into slavery and then their exile from Egypt. So it's a short version of that gigantic book that you just showed me.
Yeah.
But if anyone is interested to read that, and the interesting part of saying that is I'm 51 and I've been sitting at Passover dinner for 51 years. And by the way, when you read the Haggadah, there's a leader. It's always the eldest male that leads, and it's always the youngest male that reads the four questions. So that's always been a part of my life. But for many, 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 many years, and probably up until I began my own spiritual quest outside of this tradition I was raised with, did I really listen to the story. I heard it, and you go around the table, and the leader, the eldest male, leads it, and then there are participants who say a passage, and you go around the table, and participants will each contribute part of the story to keep everyone engaged. Then at different times, it says assembled, and the whole group will speak, And then often it goes back to the leader. Mm. I did it for, I'm going to say, 45 years until I actually heard it.
I feel like so much of my life has been like that about everything.
Yeah, me too.
I just, there's so many things that I do, that I've done, that I'm like not really sure why. And if somebody would ask me why, I'd go, I don't know. I don't care. I don't know. And I don't care.
I don't know. I just do.
I just do it. Yeah. So I, especially because I'm speaking to you, Kara, and you do know, but will you allow me to just 5 minutes be somebody that is coming from complete brand new baby lens of complete ignorance to the story of Passover? I only came into this story with, let's say, my whole life, I've even attended a Seder when I was 15. And I remember walking out and saying, I don't know who they're leaving the door open for, but these people are, like, at least in Catholicism, you're not under any illusion that somebody, that Jesus is going to walk in.
Walking in and sitting down and eating.
Oh, my word. I just feel the love for myself, honestly, in that ignorance of even saying what I just said. I'm being really vulnerable now, but I say this, like, I went to my Jewish student yesterday, and I repeated through this passionate excitement. Okay, this is an older gentleman who's been raised Jewish. This is why I love my students, because they are my teachers, and I can be me. I could be fully me in, like, I just got to this planet, by the way, just got here. Thought I knew this. Turns out I know nothing. And I can't believe the teachings in Exodus. And he just sits there and says, please tell me. And he lets me go on about Passover and what it symbolized and what it meant to me. And when I read it and how I didn't just read it with a new lens. I A-B'd it to my old one. Not that I had an old one that was symbolic, but I mean my old blocks, my old, that, who cares, or what's this mean, or why do I care, and what does it have to do with me? So I'm just saying that to you because what I'm going to repeat to you now is probably common knowledge to everybody that knows the story of Exodus, that is Jewish or has been raised Jewish. But right now, I feel like I want to go to the top of that mountain and tell everybody.
Go, girl.
And I don't feel like in a million years that I'm sitting here going, because I want to convert to Judaism or I want to go back to my Catholic roots. I am studying all of these holy scriptures, and there's not one yet that I haven't wanted to go from the mountaintop and scream down at. Do you remember that quote I read you? I'm going to curse, so if you're a child, close your eyes. There's this, I don't know who said it, but it's somewhere on the internet. It's written by Jesus, Muhammad, Moses, Buddha, and Krishna. And it says, I never fucking said that. I have it hanging up.
So, you sent it to me.
Did I?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm loving it. And it's also, I don't read it like I'm not saying that. It's just, I didn't only say that. I can see all these teachings through the lens of that they're trying to shine a light in this giant fog. And you can all see the light. We can all see this, like, reflection. It's just whether or not we want to look at it as the way or what it's like. And I don't think there's any right or wrong. I don't think if you say that it's the way that you're wrong, and I don't see if you say what it's like it's wrong. It's just however you're translating it. And for me, I'm seeing all of them saying what it's like, and it's up to me how I decide my way. Mm-hmm. So I read this story of Exodus. Again, if you're Jewish and you're appalled by my horrific translation, shut this podcast off right now. But this is my practice here, and I'm trying to be vulnerable. But so I didn't really know much about it. Turns out, here's this person, Moses, and he's on the top of this mountain. There's this burning bush, and he's even scared by the burning bush. So he like sort of hides his face, and he hears this voice of God. And God starts talking to him. They start chatting. They have this really cool conversation on this mountain. And Moses is like, why is this going on? Why have you allowed your people to be slaves? Why is this happening? Why are we going through so much torment? And what can I do? How do I get us out of this? What could I do to help? God tells him, you're going to go back down the mountain. And you're going to tell all the Israelites that you met me up here. And Moses says, oh, forget it. They're never, ever going to believe me. And God says, no, they will. And he says, no, they're not going to believe me. He says, they will, because I'm going to give you this rod. I'm also asking you to see the mythology, the beauty of the mythology here. I'm going to give you this rod. You're going to bang it down on the ground. And there were three things. I can't remember all of them. They're written down. I'm not going to go through my notes right now. But one of them was like, you bang it down, it turns into a snake. You bang it down, it turns into blood. The ground will turn into blood. There's another one. And when they see that, they're going to know. He also asks the name of God because he has to be able to say, who said this? God gives him the name. So Moses says, listen, you know, I've never been known to be a great speaker. The guy who really has the gift of gab is Aaron. Like, he knows how to talk. He's great with people. So Moses goes down. He grabs Aaron. I'm obviously skipping a ton. And he says, gathers all the elders. Okay. Aaron and Moses tell him, I met God. God said that we should, that me and Aaron are going to go to the Pharaoh of Egypt. And we're going to tell him, let go of my people. And if you don't, this is what's going to happen. So, okay, they're going to do this. So Moses and Aaron, they go in front of the Pharaoh in Egypt. And they relay the message of God to the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh says, whatever, get out of here. Well, this happens again and again and again. And each time it happens, Moses goes back up to the mountain and says to God, I told you they wouldn't believe us. In one of the instances, which I really loved, you know, Moses did what God told him to do. He took the rod, banged it down, and it turned into a snake. And the Pharaoh says, that's nothing. And calls his magicians. And the magicians, they turned something into a snake. So the Pharaoh's like, you got anything better, Moses? And Moses was like, oh, shit. Well, he does the three things with the rod and it turns to blood. And each time the Pharaoh was able to get the magicians in, and the magicians could cover that. They could do that magic, no problem. So nothing was really blowing his mind. Moving forward with that, every time he would go back up, Moses would go back up to the mountain, have a conversation with God. Moses was like, this is not happening. He's not doing anything. God would give him another thing to say and say, listen, Moses, you're going to say this to the Pharaoh and he's going to not do it, but you have to do it anyway. And so Moses would go back down. It got to locusts. I loved the frogs. All of these frogs.
Well, it's the plagues that they said.
The 10 plagues, yeah.
10 plagues, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. The 10 plagues. And some of them were frogs. Some of them were locusts.
Boils.
Yeah. All of these horrific things. And each time, like as it got towards the end of the 10, okay? I'm just going to speed it up here. But as it got towards the end of the 10, he the Pharaoh would then, they would go back in front of the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh would say, okay, already, all right, just take the frogs. Like, get them out of here. Just get all these frogs out of here. Promise me you'll do that. And Moses would say, let our people go. Let us go. And the Pharaoh would go, okay, fine, fine, just get the frogs out of here. Moses would go, he would tell the Israelites, all right, we're going to do it. God would get the frogs out because God kept his word. And the Israelites would prepare, and the Pharaoh would say, what was that, nuts? I'm not letting everybody go. I don't care. I don't care. I'm like, these frogs are gone now. Out of sight, out of mind. Get those people back. I don't know what I was thinking. We need these slaves. We need these workers here. Until, well, I don't know if it's until, but my favorite one was when he said, because of the symbology, not because of the suffering, but when he said, every firstborn, I think this was the end, every firstborn of every household.
The boy, first, the slaying of the firstborn son.
Yes. And you know what? To just back up a second, you remember when Moses said, we all want to leave, and the Pharaoh said, you know what? All the men can leave, but I'm not letting you take the women. I'm not letting you take the livestock. And Moses said, no, that's a no-go. That's a deal breaker. Like $10 for the pinky or $1 million. But that's a deal breaker. We all go or nothing. And, you know, that obviously didn't happen. So then, yes, the firstborn of each household, Moses goes back up and Moses says to God, and God says, okay, here's what you're going to do. Here's a ritual. Everybody's going to get a lamb. They're going to take it into their house. Every Israelite is going to take a lamb, bring it into their house. You're going to prepare this meal. You're going to take the blood of the lamb and you're going to put it on the doorway. And only Israelites can do this, because what's going to happen is God comes in a cloud, like a cloud, like almost like a fog, or he comes in fire or light, like some form of like light. You know, fire is light too. And after the meal, everybody's going to go to sleep, and I'm going to fly over. And any house that does not have a mark of the lamb's blood on the doorway, I'm going to kill the firstborn of each household. So Moses is like, okay.
Firstborn son. Sorry.
Was it the firstborn son? Mm-hmm. Because what if households didn't have a firstborn son in them? It was, from what I read in here, like, please excuse my ignorance, but it was a
You can correct me if I'm wrong. I thought it was the firstborn son.
I'm pretty sure, and I could be wrong, that it was the firstborn, because every household had a firstborn of something.
Okay.
But I could be wrong. Anyway.
I could be wrong too.
So God, you know, everybody's sleeping. Everybody does the ritual, this beautiful ritual. Okay. God's going to come over and he's going to go to all the houses that don't have it, the lamb's blood on the door. And that's exactly what happened. So why is that called? Yeah, yeah. Like, it feels like an ending, but it's not an ending. And anyway, no.
The question is.
I mean, but it was my introduction to really understanding that. So, of course, what is God doing? He's passing over the houses that have the lamb's blood, the Israelite homes. He's passing over their house. That's why it's called Passover. Next day, wake up. The Pharaoh wakes up. All these people are dead. There's screaming coming from all places in Egypt, all for miles. And the Pharaoh says, okay, I've had enough. That's it. And gathers up everybody and says, we got to get the Israelites out of here. Let's it. We're done. Israelites get the message. But the thing that I found amazing was that the Israelites at this point, which we all feel when we've had enough suffering, we think we've had enough suffering. The Egyptians felt like we had enough suffering. Just make it be gone. They wanted to push out the suffering, just get it gone. So they said to all the Israelites, you don't have time for nothing. You get back home, you get the quickest thing you can, and get on your way. And all the Israelites were like, well, he's changed his mind so many times, we better get out of here. So they couldn't even wait for the bread to be baked. So that is why the Jews are not eating, they're having unleavened bread at Passover. Because they didn't even have time to wait for the bread to rise. They grab their bags, they split. The Egyptians were like, get him out. And they start their journey into the wilderness. What do you think happens? The Pharaoh, once separated from his suffering, as we are, once you gave birth to one child and said, I'll never do it again, bam, you got pregnant again. Because the pain is just an ancient mystery, just like the Pharaoh. And he says, what did I do? Now we have nobody to work. Like, everybody gather the troops, go after them. So the Israelites, who think they're free, they start being followed by the Egyptians, the troops. And that story, like, then breaks off and starts to talk about how when, because nobody was special in this story, which is what I loved about it. The Israelites following Moses to get out of exile. I'm exaggerating now, but just imagine if every day they're on this journey, right? Just in the wilderness part. And they don't have enough food. They don't have enough water. They don't have a lot of stuff because they had to leave suddenly. And all of a sudden, the Israelites, the people started saying to Moses, like, hey, man, you took me out of Egypt for this? Like, I was starving in Egypt, and now I'm starving in the wilderness. How is this any better? And Moses would keep talking to God, going, like, now they're turning on me. Like, you put us out here. You made me take everybody out of here. You got to give us some water. You got to give us some bread the next day. You got to give us some shelter the next day. But the whole time they're there, even the Israelites were doubting and questioning. And like, here's Moses like, dude, I'm just trying to help. And now the Egyptians are on their tail. They get to the water. They're like, forget it. We can't get through it. Bam. Moses puts the rod down, and the whole thing parts, the whole water parts, and makes this like tunnel for the Israelites to walk right through. Fast forward. Okay, I know I'm fast forwarding. The Egyptians don't go all the way into the tunnel, or they do, but God throws them back in at some point. And either way, they end up dead. And they see their bodies on the side, right? By this point, Kara, that's where I'm going to end it. But by this point, I cannot put this book down. Because I read it as this like roadmap for the spiritual journey itself. The fact that the Pharaoh is the ego mind, never, ever satisfied, always, always, what's next? What's next? You're suffering? Push it away. I'm supposed to be happy. I want everything my way. Always changing its mind.
By the way, didn't the Pharaoh have a child?
I didn't want to get that far. But well, is that prior?
That was slain.
Yes, didn't Moses kill him?
His child.
Yes, Moses killed his child, and nothing changed from that. So Moses himself in that moment realized that there was nothing that was going to get them out of this. Like, that changed nothing. Yes, that was a profound part. I forgot. I'm sorry about that.
Just in how, like you said, his ego mind was just not, there was no budget.
Well, what I think it was meaning to me, at least, and it probably means this to every Jew, and here I am showing up to the party late, but it's obvious to me that these teachings are the teachings of the human predicament. They're the teachings of we are all the Pharaoh in the ego mind, and we are all Moses in the heart. We are all trying to lead ourselves out of our suffering. Listen, in the story, yes, way more severe than our times right now, but it wasn't always that way for our people. There's many cultures that are still right now suffering in that way, in the way of feeling trapped in their country by their own people all the time. And we are all showing up in life with a juggling act, a ping-ponging between, do I want to go to my Aunt Shirley's wedding or do I not? Well, I love you, but I don't. And it's not about believing the Jewish word or the Jewish people or feeling special in your Jewishness. It's that we're cutting the baby off with the bathwater. I cut my own baby off with the bathwater, or my circumstances did, in not allowing me to see that all of these stories have this duality, this moment when we're all trying to fight the Pharaoh of our mind and be in the beauty of what's real and present for Moses. He was in, they were being persecuted. That's true. And then we have God, who is the Spirit, and Moses is communicating with God. But we're all of those things. We're all the Pharaoh and Moses and God. And to see, I mean, I literally look at my notes here. I mean, I'm just enthralled by the whole entire story. Not that the Jewish Bible is any more special than any other Bible, but the stories through a lens of archetypes, of the human model. It is why this will never go away. The Torah will never go away. I hope it never does. Neither will the Bible. But if it's the way, we have to build walls towards keeping everybody out. Everybody non-Jewish has to then stay out of this. And that is what got me in this place, that at my age now, I'm just first really getting to grips with even being enough out of my ego mind to be able to pick it up. The same with the other religions that I study. And I saw this as this beautiful way to connect to that which we do not know. All the people, all the Israelites that kept doubting Moses through that whole time, do you think that was very fair? I mean, all he was trying to do was good. That's all our spirit is trying to do, is good. And in that moment, all the Israelites that kept, you know, where's our food? Where's our, we might as well be back in Egypt because at least we had a warm fire. I mean, these are the words that I read here. So how many times have you and I done that? That's how we started this conversation, is what is love? Love is not something that we can speak with words. That's the Tao. That anything that can be spoken about is not truth, because we don't have the ability in language to make sense to the Pharaoh. Which is exactly what Moses tried to do. He tried to make sense to the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh said he got it, and then he changed his mind. And how many times have we done that? It's just, we're all Hebrews. We're all Hebrews.
We all have a Hebrew in us.
Yeah, and we all have a Pharaoh and a Moses and a spirit. Yeah. And if you don't want to call it that, call it Muhammad, call it Jesus. Like, the point is that we're only spiting ourselves by sectioning it off. I have only spited myself by sectioning it off. It wasn't by a choice of mine. It was just the condition that I was born into. Not like a bad condition. I'm very grateful for my entire life. But if we don't seek that which we're opposed to, or that which we think we know when we don't, all these teachings showed me is how absolutely infantile my belief of grasping any teachings are. It's at its infancy, because I saw myself through the whole story as each one of these characters, just like I was taught the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu text. I am both Krishna, I am both Arjuna, I am both the blind king, and I am I forgot his name, Yudhishthira. I'm pronouncing it completely wrong. So I just want to say that we have all been passed over, right? We have all been passed over in one way or another, whether it's because you're being bullied at school, you're being passed over. Whether you didn't get the guy you like, you were passed over. You got fired from the job, they passed you over. Somebody's passed away. We've been passed over. The human condition is about that. So without that, there is no human condition. So if you didn't say no to your mother and then have these thoughts, we remain just in this separateness, this constant pushing away from like, well, why does my family tell me I got to be there for Seder? It's not so important why they said that. What's more important is who in you is meeting those words that you're hearing from your parents or from your kids or from your boss. What part of you are you showing up as?
Which is what I've seen change in me, which is why it's so wonderful to question and see how you react to the same question 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 5 years ago, and yesterday. Hmm. Same predicament, different reaction.
Yeah, and I would imagine that that happens as you get older, but I don't think without a practice that there's any way, shape, or form I could be doing that. And it's only excited me to remain in this spot of the beginner and just being curious, because I learned from this. It wasn't just the mind-blowing archetypes and mythology, whether it's real or not. I mean, listen, there is so much unreal that we have all signed up for. One of them happens every year in the religion I was brought up in. And we're all signed up for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're getting the warm fire and we're getting the hot cup of tea and we're getting the food. And so, sure, I'll go along with God on this journey through the wilderness, because I'm speaking of Christmas, because that's all I can really directly speak of. That's what I was feeling. And so we've taken something like that and we've appropriated it to give us what we think we need, which is presence and everybody around us that we love, and only people that we love, because everybody else we don't love. And this is Christmas, and so I need to keep everybody else out. When the teachings of Christmas in regards to Jesus are as profound as this, but as long as we want to keep walking around with, well, why am I here in this wilderness? I don't care about this. I just want to be out of suffering. As long as we stay in that place of trying to get rid, we can't find anything sacred. So we're making the teachings too much around us, so much that it's bubbling us in, and we're pushing the beauty of how this is the story of the spiritual journey for every human being. That's why I loved your story, Kara, about your mom, because that is completely in these teachings, you know, all of these teachings. And I guess it's to interpret this in Jewish culture, it's called Midrash. Have you heard that?
No.
Midrash is what scholars or religious people will do, is they'll sit around and they'll try to find truth in spiritual teachings, right? So it's called Midrash, and you're interpreting them in way bigger ways. So what I'm saying is, why aren't we all doing that in our life? Like, why aren't we all walking around going, well, what does this arm represent? Or what does this job represent? What is this opposition I have to my boss telling me to do something that's outside of my job description? Why am I so opposed to that? And immediately, the Pharaoh of our mind is going to say, because he's not respecting me and he doesn't know my talent and I've put enough up with enough bullshit and that's not my job description. Okay, then what? What else? Go deeper. Not deeper in a therapeutic sort of cognitive way, although you can. That's great too. But what I've found is there's something even deeper, deeper under.
What is it about you that just won't do it? What would it do to you to actually just not go through all those words and just do it? That happens to me often, especially now.
Or go through the words and see who in you shows up and how does that serve you and how does it serve others? Because it doesn't serve me when I'm saying to my sister, Jenna, you know, screw you, Jenna. I don't even know that girl. Don't ask me to go to her brother's mother's, you know, hospital bed. How dare you? No, it doesn't serve Jenna because she feels unloved in that moment that I'm not showing up for her. And I feel appalled in that moment that she's not showing up for me, trying to protect me and my time with somebody that I, quote unquote, don't know. So her and I are both at odds and we're both wanting the same thing. And we're both not serving ourselves or each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so to look at the interpretations of that, I love the Jewish Midrash. I love that because that defines, it's a better word than interpretation. It's a sort of way to be respectful and honor these teachings that they may be real and they also may be showing what it's like. They might be it, and they also might be trying to get us to see how valuable all of the suffering and the happiness is, that it's all a part of the practice of being human. You don't have to be a yogi. It has nothing to do with it. So, yeah, I hope everybody forgives me in my ignorance of all that I do not know. But I just had to tell you that. So can you correct me on anything that I might have screwed up just so I can learn before we sign off?
No, I don't know that particular, you know, translation or that particular rendition. It's pretty much is the story, and you have to shorten it to get it into this conversation. But
well, that wasn't an interpretation I got from this book. The book read it like the book read it. The interpretation was just mine.
Right.
There's I did go wrong. On and find other people saying that same interpretation that I was. So that's when I realized, you're an idiot, Katrina. This is probably exactly why people are practicing Judaism or, you know, their religions, their prospective religions. Probably everybody knows this. That's why I'm being vulnerable, because every Jew out there is probably going, yeah, we know.
Well, the tradition, just to clarify, the Seder, so what it is, and for me, like I said, that was a very recent aha moment for all the sittings I did at the dinner tables, was exactly what you said about that meal. So we sit at a Seder table the evening before Passover begins, because that would have been the night that they had that big meal, and put the blood on the doors before they went to bed. So as we sit and tell the story again, and it's the same story every year, just as you told it, about the plagues and about, you know, the Pharaoh not giving them exile, not allowing them to leave their slavery.
Our human existence.
Is that we say, here we are, year after year, after year, telling the story. So as our families grow and our children are born and they grow, nobody forgets that we had to endure that slavery and get to that point to free our people from the land and from the slavery and have gratitude. And because everyone is not sitting down and reading the books like you are, they're passing that knowledge along to their children about what. You hear Passover. Oh, it's Passover. School's closed. It's Passover. Oh, there's matzah in the store. It's Passover. But like you said, if you stop 10 people, how many of them will really know what that means? So the learning of it, the story behind it, that is an actual story born of an actual event and carried on for all these years is interesting. And read about the four questions. Because that's interesting, too. And why the youngest son reads the four questions. In my family, so I've seen, so, as I sit around the Seder table, and now I'm more aware, I look around and remember when each one in the room, now from 20 down to 1 year old, has come to that age in second grade or whenever you start reading, and it's their year to read the four questions. It's an honor.
Oh, wow. That's a ritual. How, you see how we're making fun of yogis and Hindus and Buddhists and all sorts of people are making fun of, why do you have to bow down? Why do you have to ring a bell? Why do you have to light incense? We're all doing the same thing. Everybody's doing the same thing. And if we stop being so opposed to our own thing, if you're Jewish Passover, if you're Catholic Christmas, and you get to the nugget of the teachings, maybe we all won't be pushing each other away from, like we're in a boxing ring and you go to your corner and I'll go to my corner. Why are you making fun of us? Because I'm practicing yoga and you think you know what that is, or you're a practicing Jew and I think I know what that is. I had to be passed over to learn about Passover. Mm. That's the irony of it. And meanwhile, I'm sitting there with a half-Jewish mother my whole life. And my mother tells me, when I started reading the Torah, she says to me, oh, do you know why we eat leavened bread? No, please tell me why. She said, because in the desert, there was no baking materials. So we couldn't bake bread. So now none of us can have flour because you couldn't make flour in the desert. But I read that and it's not what it said at all. So it's the game of telephone.
It was in their haste to leave and it couldn't prepare.
Do you know the difference of that teaching to me in an archetypal kind of spiritual lens, human condition way? That's a big difference to me. Yeah. That becomes a totally different story option. Not better or worse, but, and I'm not saying my mother should know. What I'm saying is that if I just left it there, that's an example for me of how I learned Catholicism. It was just left at Christmas and Santa and presents. It wasn't for me because I went on, you know, I'm me and I'm crazy, but for the most part, the spiritual but not religious, we're loading on more stuff to us in the material possession land, the belief system land, the roles and model land, and all it's doing is stopping us from having any more space to actually just stop, like you are, Kara, and saying, wait a minute, what is that actually? Oh, wow, that's why, or that's why? I don't even think at this point it's a lot to ask from somebody. And if all of a sudden there was a rule passed from the government that said you can no longer call yourself a label of Christian, Catholic, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, unless you go through a teacher training. I know we think that's what bar mitzvahs and bas mitzvahs and communions and confirmations are, but I did that and I didn't get that from that. So there's either that we're not learning that, or we're just at an age at that place where we're so closed off as children. I don't know. I don't claim to know. But it's an individual journey.
I think that you're just told what to do. I think you're told you know.
But why don't you care is my question. Why doesn't anybody care?
I think they more so don't want to participate. 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 10-year-olds. They don't want to go through the bar mitzvah process and learn to read another language and go to Hebrew school. And the Catholic children don't want to go to religion and Catholic school. They don't want to do that. It is a hindrance in their social life.
But why is it, and tell me this honestly, is it that parents aren't taking the responsibility that when their 5-year-old is upset about getting a toy taken away by another child, they're not referring not to their mind of, well, that's his toy or you've got to share. Kids hear that and they go, why do I have to share? It means nothing. Why not go back to whatever ancient teachings and make it new to that child and say, well, that's exactly what Moses felt like when he tried to tell everybody, you know, listen, I just spoke to God, and everybody was like, whatever. Like, why? Come up with different names, but keep the core stories of it. But somehow the core stories become of no value, and they're uncool, or kids don't want to know about it, or the parents don't want to know about it. I didn't want to know about it. So it's like, that's where the personal responsibility comes in of, if you're going to say that you are this, what does that mean? What does that really mean? Because what it's doing is it's watering down all of us as humans in our humanness, that we can't do a ritual because you're not this, or you can't do this because you're not that. I'm not saying that we should separate ourselves. It's to actually come together to teach each other. And that is the job of a parent. It's guiding. And if it doesn't resonate to them in the words of, like, the titles of the names of God or Jesus or Moses, come on, we're creative enough, aren't we? To say it in the Winnie the Pooh. Say it in any way you want, but then when they're old enough, they'll see for themselves, wow, that's what Jesus was trying to teach me. That's what Krishna was trying to teach me. Oh man, why did I blow off the Bhagavad Gita or the Torah? Or why did I just sing that song at my bar mitzvah and not care? You know, you have to not care to care, because you have to get passed over to understand Passover. I'm saying that it's all part of it. It is. It's all the beauty of it, but it is a personal responsibility that if you're out there making fun of somebody that's bowing to somebody's feet or only going to temple when it's Passover or Rosh Hashanah, why don't you look in the mirror?
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you look in the mirror? Because when I looked in the mirror, I was appalled enough to cultivate a curiosity to just go, whatever, man, I'm going to read it and be a brand new baby in reading it. And I'm going to lay myself out there and say, wow, check that out. What is the harm in that? You want answers on how to break up with your boyfriend or how to quit your job or how to find a happy marriage? I got news for you. It was written about thousands of years ago about how to get rid of your job you hate. And if we open our mind to come up with our own interpretations for what that means to us, even if it's not wrapped up in a nice Christmas bow or a Hanukkah menorah, Where's your creativeness to apply it to yourself or just for yourself? We can't teach our kids or our youth anything until we can apply it to ourselves. And it's not saying that we know anything. It's actually going the opposite way. I know nothing, so let's create this together. We're guides for each other. And all my only interest lies in, I want my mind blown every day. And not everybody has to want their mind blown every day. But don't penalize other people. Jews, Catholics, Muslims. Don't penalize everybody when you're not even checking your references. Or I'll even go so far as to say, you're not even curious. You're just saying, I don't know, just because. Why do you not like that person? I don't know. They rubbed me the wrong way. What does that mean? Like, all of that nonsense has to stop. And it can only stop inside of me. And I'm 2% of where I would like to be. I'd love to be 50%, but I'm not. So I'm learning from that 2%. And if this is 2% and my mind is blown every day that I can't put down a Torah for 12 hours because I'm enthralled by reading it and I'm a guinea from New York, that's a rock and roll singer? Oh man, I got news for you. There's a lot of people out there that I say just get curious. That's it. So, Kara, thank you for that story. I also want to recommend that if you're interested in things like the Midrash and interpreting lots of things, there's this really cool guy. I'm trying to grab his name now. A lot of people know him, Dr. Robert Rosenthal. He's a board-certified psychiatrist and psychotherapist. Don't let that scare you away. Mm-hmm. But he has a translation that when I read it, it was word for word how I first read the Jewish Bible. And I thought, oh my God, this is incredible. Not like I thought of it or anything, because I'm definitely not too caught up in my Pharaoh in that place. But when I read his, it was pretty much word for word what I had felt when I read it the first time. So you don't need to know anything. Just pick up something other than, you know, a science fiction novel, you know, just once get curious. So you can read about him. I'll also post his name up on the blog. And so I also learned from you that it's not happy Pesach or Passover. It's good. Now, why is that?
Because I don't think they were having a celebratory time. They weren't having a happy occasion.
But were they having a good time?
Well, a good meal.
A good
meal. You know what? I think they were wishing each other a good meal.
Okay.
You know, so good Pesach, maybe good luck, you know, but they didn't know what was going to happen back then.
Right.
They didn't know that would work. God was coming down to slay children. I mean, you know, they just had to have faith in their, you know, destiny and in Moses and God's word.
And I love that they didn't. I love that through the whole story, nobody really had any faith except in the ego mind. This sucks. That sucks. I want this. I want that. Give me more. Give me less. That's the greatest part about it. It's saying that we're here to question and we're here to develop faith. And it really is about the people in us, you know, like take the journey like Moses did. Climb up that mountain, climb up the ladder of your job, go through your shitty marriage or your great marriage or whatever it is that is your human condition. Everybody's is different.
Look at the progression, right? Because
I love that it was wilderness. I really can't wait to figure out, because after wilderness, then it's desert, the desert, right?
Yeah.
See, I'm so young to this that I haven't read past that, the wilderness, because I think you should read this for a year first, but I want to see what the changes of seasons are. So I asked that client that I shared this with. He knows a rabbi who will take me into study. So, yeah, that's what I'm embarking on now. And I'm
coming to California for your bat mitzvah.
Oh, listen, come for my bat mitzvah, my the
you know, you can't do that, by the way. I learned another thing about Judaism that I also didn't know, is that you don't have a bar mitzvah, you are a bar mitzvah.
See, that is so awesome to me.
What it means, the literal translation, and again,
well, it's obvious, it, right?
It pertained to males, and pertaining to females is a modernized version based on the celebrations that Jewish people have for turning 13. But the expression, you become a bar mitzvah on your 13th birthday.
Become a man, right?
You become a man. And it is a just an honor and a rite of passage, but you hear people say, oh, he's having his bar mitzvah. It's actually the wrong expression.
Wow, and so you lose the teaching with just one word.
Right.
Have or be.
Be
it's the same thing in all of these teachings. All of them. You're either going to do because something or you're going to be something.
It comes down to a party.
Well, I think if you have a bar mitzvah, then things are, you're having something. But if you have to actually be something, that takes a different commitment. And, you know, I say, what if we all embraced all of these teachings and we stopped having the get a bar mitzvah or get confirmed or communion, if they're going to mean anything other than participating in your human incarnation. You know what I mean? Like, can it be that? Like, now I'm participating in a way that the rest of my culture sees me as being responsible. But I think it starts way, way, way earlier than that anyway.
Yeah.
But we've turned all of these things away from rituals. So then anybody else that's coming along with rituals, quote unquote, looks culty. But I got news for you, man. If you were to see a chart on my wall of all the different religions that this world has to offer and all the rituals you have to go through or be or have, we're all doing it. And we're doing it even if you don't have religion. You're doing it in brushing your teeth because your teeth are going to fall out. You're doing it in, I want this guy, so I'm going to be thin. All of the stuff we do, that we're involved in rituals to do them. We all are. So why be so opposed to it? We just have to like widen the scope. And God, I know so little about it, but I'm really glad that I got you while it was still Passover, because, you know, it's going to be a little bit more apropos maybe to people. And I'm excited to start on that journey. And there's many other journeys that I'm doing. So I'm so glad that you could join me again, Kara. And sorry to everybody for this being so long, but I have to put this out as one podcast, one episode. So maybe you'll just have to listen to it over the days of Passover. So if you want to find out more info about Zooming in the Lens podcast, you can go to functionalyogaonline.com. And Kara, do you have any last words?
Good Pesach.
Good Pesach.
No, thank you for having me. As always, great fun talking and chatting. And we seem to be able to go on and on and on and on. So I'm sure we will. Next topic, next time.
Absolutely. And if you want to recommend any topics, just go over to the website. Go over to the Facebook, Functional Yoga, .com/Facebook. Sorry, God, I can't talk. Facebook.com/functional yoga. And write to us and come up with topics. We've got some really cool ones coming up. Ones that I'm really looking forward to. So I hope you'll stay tuned and subscribe on iTunes. And always, this is free. We're not making a dime doing this. We are in practice. We're not asking you for anything other than to just be curious and have an open mind. And if we're really good students and teachers, then we will have pissed off some of you. And if we have pissed off some of you, go do something that's going to serve yourself and others without creating violence, that's going to educate yourself on why that might be and what is really at the heart of it. So to everybody out there, have a great holiday. And namaste.
Explain to us the spiritual meaning of Passover.
We were born with a negative force called the ego. It's written, I have created the evil inclination. That's what the Creator says, the apple force. And it's written, I have created the Torah as a spice. What does that mean? Torah means, light. There's a special light that influences us and can invert our negative inclination into a positive one. Bad will into goodwill. To balance our desires so that the good and bad in each of us will be balanced. Because having only the good force without the bad, or the bad without the good, is unsustainable. So the wisdom of Kabbalah explains to us how we achieve a life of balance between the two forces, bad, good, reception, and giving. And we achieve harmony between these two forces. Equilibrium between us, connection between us, internal tranquility, a state where we are, where we transcend our bodies. It's as if we exit it. It does exist, but our perception, our worldview extends way beyond our lives. You get this feeling. It is possible for every person on condition that we correct our nature to some extent, so that in addition to our ego, we will acquire the power of Torah, the power of light, a little bit of love of others. This is what Passover talks about. So when Jews came out of Egypt, they received the Torah. What does it say? Love your neighbor as yourself. That's the great rule of Torah, meaning we have to connect among us with the power of love, and then the whole world.
Music and editing. Special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpixmixforpix.com.